Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center Network. I'm Laura Kerrigan, your volunteer reader. Today is Monday, June 8th, 2026, and here's your news from USA Today. Our lead story, young people losing faith. Government mistrust dampens civic education. This is written by Carissa Waddick. Bathed in the glare of her classroom's fluorescent lights, Kit Vaughns mulled how others her age felt about the nation's future. There's so much going on right now, and it's kind of overwhelming, said Vaughns, age 18, who recently told a small group of other Virginia seniors slouched over their desks in the Alexandria City High School government class. They were discussing research on Gen Z attitudes toward democracy. Vaughns's classmate, David George Feit, said he had found it hard to avoid a hopeless mindset. A history buff, Feit added that he'd become dismayed by the political chaos he had seen in the news. Trust in government among young Americans is at a record low. This is according to the most recent Harvard Youth Poll. The survey, published in April, found just 26% of 18 to 29-year-olds hopeful about the country's future. The results reflect an erosion of faith in the nation's democratic systems among young Americans across partisan lines. To cut through the malaise, federal and state lawmakers are looking to bolster civics education. Experts believe boosting young people's understanding of government and Americans' rights and responsibilities could help reduce political divisions and vitriol. They see the country's 250th birthday as the start of a potential decade-long civic renaissance. This year's kindergartners will have their education bookended by the anniversaries of the Declaration of Independence and the ratification of the Constitution. This really is a runaway. Nope, this really is a runway, said Sean Healy, Chief Policy and Advocacy Officer at iCivics, a nonpartisan group providing civics resources to students and teachers. But educators say the realities of the country's deep divisions are making it more difficult than ever to teach students about the government. Classrooms in turmoil. On Sundays after church, community members used to stop and commend Kimberly Huffman for educating kids about the Constitution. Nowadays, when the service ends and Huffman leaves her pew, her neighbors question whether she's teaching the right Constitution. At one parent conference last fall, Huffman said a mother asked whether she was teaching her child to be a Democrat. It was the first time she had received that question in her 32 years as an American government instructor. Her community in Wayne County, Ohio, has been a Republican stronghold for half a century. It voted for Donald Trump in the past three presidential elections. Until the past few years, political rancor had never seeped into Huffman's classroom. Now, once matter-of-fact lessons have become tense. The curriculum for juniors and seniors at the county's vocational high school, where Huffman teaches, covers four founding documents: the Constitution, Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, and the State Constitution. Huffman sticks steadfastly to the words of the documents. She doesn't belong to either political party and encourages students to check her voter registration. Still, they routinely interrogate her treatment of topics like presidential powers. I still face hints of accusations of being biased, even though I feel like I'm tiptoeing. I feel like I'm being meticulously cautious, said Huffman. A tense climate. In an iCivic survey published in January, more than half of teachers reported a fear of backlash for covering something the wrong way and said basic civics concepts had become difficult to teach. David Baugh, president of the Bill of Rights Institute, a civics-focused educational organization founded by libertarian Charles Koch, pointed to the country's antagonistic political climate as the culprit. Over the past decade, deep political divisions have influenced the way many Americans view the nation's history. Democratic lawmakers at the state and federal levels have pushed to expand history curricula to include more on the slave trade and treatment of Native Americans and other marginalized groups. Republican lawmakers have argued these efforts unnecessarily disparage Americans. They have moved to ban the telling of divisive or anti-American ideology. Policymakers from both parties have also introduced a slew of proposals to invest in civics education. But much like conversations about how to tell the country's history, many of those ideas are split along ideological lines. Conservative politicians have criticized civics initiatives that encourage students to participate in their communities, saying these tactics push activism. Meanwhile, Democrats have accused the Trump administration of presenting a biased view in its programs. The Department of Education last year emphasized a focus on patriotic education and awarded more than $150 million in history and civics grants. The agency also helped launch the America 250 Civics Education Coalition, bringing together predominantly conservative organizations to create K-12 and higher education programming. Bob believes the dogmatic way lawmakers talk about civics has had a chilling effect. What that means is that adults and young people alike start having that same aversion to civics as they do to politics, he said. Teachers are coming into this kind of climate, raring to make civics an antidote, but the young people still have a bit of trepidation. Seeing eye to eye. When students sit down in Jennifer Klein's classroom each semester, they make a forecast, not of the weather, but of American politics. Some say it's sunny and bright. Others say it's cloudy with a chance of torrential rain. Over the past few years, Klein said, the answers in her Pittsburgh school have trended gloomier. She also has seen the change in sentiment reflected in students' increasing hesitancy to express their opinions at the start of every school year. It's a trend Josh Dunn, a professor at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, has also witnessed in his classes. For the students, so many of them fear saying something that might get them, for lack of a better word, canceled, said Dunn, who's also executive director of the school's Institute of American Civics. Educators like Klein and Dunn see their classes playing a fundamental role in helping the next generation learn how to effectively and politely communicate disagreements. During a recent lesson on Federalist Paper No. 70, Klein watched her once timid students begin to relish debating one another. They were discussing Alexander Hamilton's defense of a strong executive branch in the 1788 document. To defend their position, students shouted across the room examples from history and current events. Some laughed as their classmates persuaded them. Once they know they don't have to be right all the time, once they realize that there's more than just one other point of view, it kind of opens their minds, said Klein. Kids gain a deeper understanding. In his third-floor government classroom at Alexandria City High School, Fite and his classmates studied white poster boards featuring the major projects they had completed throughout the year-long course. They had researched federal agencies, interpreted judicial opinions based on their understanding of the Constitution, staged a mock Congress, and met with city officials about public policy issues important to young people. Fite said the assignments have helped him reconcile his fears with a deeper understanding of the country's systems. Zenise Granberry, age 17, reflected for several minutes on the mock Congress. For the project, she portrayed a Hispanic Republican congressman from Texas. Before the assignment, Granberry, a second-generation American whose grandparents emigrated from Jamaica, didn't understand how a person of color could identify as a Republican. When I first started researching him, I was like, yeah, there's no way I'm going to embody this person, said Granberry, laughing. So she called the representative's office to learn more. He ended up emailing back and forth with her. It was cool to understand where he was coming from, she said. Granberry still doesn't agree with many of the congressman's positions, but the project did alter her perspective. A lot of people have a negative connotation of people just based on which side they're on, red or blue, she said. I don't think it should be such a rah-rah situation. Also on the front page, we have this story. Economic pressure has Cuba in tailspin. Slow-motion collapse, U.S. tactic to end regime. This is written by Kim Helmgard and Francesca Chambers. Total economic and humanitarian strangulation, a Cuba death spiral, appears to be the United States' latest tactic in its 67-year quest to topple the island nation's communist government. First, the Trump administration floated a far-reaching economic deal to open up tourism, attract investment, and perhaps make good on long-simmering Cuban-American compensation claims. Then it prepared a series of secret military options, including a snatch-and-grab-style gambit reminiscent of the United States' capture of Venezuela's former president, Nicolas Maduro. Now the plan appears to be a painful, slow-motion collapse. After months of escalating pressure on Cuba, President Donald Trump appears intent on choking its communist-run government into political and economic capitulation. This is according to people familiar with the administration's thinking on the Caribbean island, seasoned Cuba watchers, and the view of some Cuban diplomats who are trying to piece together months of ambiguous but ultimately threatening signals from Washington. An executive order went into effect June 5, freezing the U.S. assets belonging to foreign companies and individuals that do business with the Cuban regime. On June 4, the Trump administration issued sanctions against Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel and members of his immediate family, along with former leader Raúl Castro's son, Alejandro Castro Espín, an official in the Interior Ministry, and grandson Raúl Alejandro Castro Caliz. An economic strangehold could collapse Cuba's regime quickly, without military involvement, said a person close to the White House who was not able to speak publicly. It's all part of what the Trump administration sees as a process that could take as long as a year to unfold. Victoria Coates, a former deputy national security advisor to the president and close ally of the administration, said. A threat of military force from Trump is real, added Coates, but that doesn't mean it's going to be the first resort. Imara Vargas Walter, Cuba's ambassador to the United Kingdom, said in a USA Today interview that the U.S. strategy toward Cuba, while multidimensional, appeared intent on suffocating the island into submission. This is not a regular dispute. It is something totally politically deliberate, a systematic policy of strangulation, she said. Every single aspect of daily Cuban life is being impacted, from the inability to refrigerate food to education, from lack of medicines to rationing water. You name it, it is really, really difficult. Understanding the motivation. The choice before Cuba is clear, the Trump administration has said. The regime can make a deal, or the United States will continue hitting businesses, institutions, and the island's elite with financially damaging sanctions. The Cubans are really, really, really good at rope-a-dope. They've been doing it for 60 years. They just delay, 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 said Pedro Frere, a lawyer who advises U.S.-based companies on business transactions with Cuba. The administration is telling them that doesn't work. To be sure, Cuba was in the midst of a perfect humanitarian storm when Trump gave Secretary of State Marco Rubio broad authority to cripple Cuba's ruling class with sanctions. Cuba has been unable to import oil since January because of a naval blockade and other restrictions placed on it by the Trump administration. Energy shortages and blackouts are a common occurrence. Hospitals have been forced to suspend non-emergency operations. Food and essential supplies are dwindling. The United States has indicated it's prepared to provide $100 million in humanitarian aid to Cuba. Rubio made the offer on May 13th during a trip to the Vatican and Italy. But the assistance comes with a condition. Neither the Cuban government nor the military would be permitted to oversee its distribution. Instead, the aid would need to be channeled through humanitarian and faith-based organizations such as Caritas, the Catholic Church's Global Relief Network, as well as other nonprofit groups. The proposed arrangement reflects Washington's stated preference of supporting the Cuban people while also making clear its lack of trust in the Cuban government's ability or even willingness to manage and distribute the aid. Rubio told lawmakers on June 2nd that even though the Cuban government said it is willing to accept the aid, there's no plan to distribute it. No money has changed hands. Cuba's top diplomat in the United Kingdom said she had no recent information about the distribution of this aid. She referred a USA Today reporter to previous comments on the topic by Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez Paria. Paria has said that Cuba, as a rule, does not reject foreign aid that is offered in good faith. Understanding the Cuba endgame. A number of factors appear to be influencing Trump's Cuba policy, though what the endgame is unclear. He often speaks about Cuba's economic and commercial potential, as he has in other places around the world where it has used the U.S. military. Trump has also appears to want a Cuban government generally more compliant with his demands. "We just want them to be a nicely run country that can feed its people," said Trump to USA Today on June 4th. Trump said that Cuba has sort of collapsed and the United States would be handling it after Iran. "We have some very good plans for Cuba," he added. The United States has developed a playbook for how it would respond if Cuba were to break down, said two sources familiar with the matter to USA Today. The plans that have existed for decades include economic, judicial, and governance reforms. Every American president, Democrat and Republican, since Cuba's 1959 revolution, has sought a leadership change in the Cold War-era adversary that sits just 90 miles from the U.S. mainland. The current White House is no different. On May 20th, the Justice Department ratcheted up pressure on the regime by charging former Cuban President Raul Castro with multiple criminal counts, including conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals in connection with the downing of two American planes 30 years ago. The United States indicted Venezuela's Maduro shortly before sending special forces to capture him and his wife to stand trial. The June 5 sanctions on foreign investors in Cuba could also speed up the process. Major companies such as Spanish hotel chains Melia and Iberostar have limited their operations on the island. "There isn't a single business that's going to invest in Cuba until something changes. So that's it. They're done. It's just a matter of time," said Rick Herrero, executive director of the Cuba Study Group, a Washington-based nonprofit policy and advocacy group. Walter, Cuba's ambassador to the United Kingdom, said that the Cuban people are surviving, in some cases, on as little as one meal a day. "They are rationing food, catching rainwater to bathe and drink, and cooking with coal because there is no oil." As the U.S. squeeze on Cuba shows few signs of relenting, Rubio, Trump's top diplomat, who was born of Cuban exiles in Florida, said at a June 2nd hearing that he still does not believe Cuba's system is capable of reform unless new leaders take over or a new mindset takes hold, he added. Our next headline, $215 million gifted to improve women's health. This is written by Laura Trujillo. Melinda French Gates has learned that when men don't do the right thing, people look to women for answers. She's had plenty of them. The philanthropist and author has given more than $400 million to fund women's health in the past 2 years. She's advocated for access to contraceptives and abortions. Now she's donating an additional $215 million to improve women's health, including during menopause, her first investment in midlife women. I'm both using my voice here and my money to say this is incredibly important, she tells USA Today. We ought to be pouring a lot more money into this area so women can thrive, so they can step into their full power. There's so much more we can do. French Gates, age 61, has long been vocal about helping women. She spent 24 years with the Gates Foundation, which she co-founded with her then-husband Bill Gates, giving away more than $100 billion, much focused on global health, including maternal care and health inequities. The couple divorced in 2021, and while details of their agreement were kept private, it included a reported multi-billion dollar fund to support French Gates' philanthropic work. She has left the foundation in 2024 and began Pivotal. Her commitment shifted after the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade and left abortion rights up to the states, and led her to pledge $1 billion to help women and families. For too long, a lack of money has forced organizations fighting for women's rights into a defensive posture, while the enemies of progress play offense, she said at the time. I want to help even the match. French Gates' latest donation is inspired by what she's seen in her extensive travels, from women's clinics in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to schools in Malawi, and in her own life. Whether she's walking with her friends through Seattle on a misty Monday morning, or on a ski trip with friends when one of the women had to literally leave the table because she had a hot flash, menopause is a big topic. Some of her friends, she says, visited multiple physicians before receiving treatment. One in five women goes a year before a doctor diagnoses her menopause. This is according to one survey. Another showed that 5% of women seeking help for perimenopause or menopause saw 11 doctors before getting help. French Gates considers herself lucky. Her three closest friends are a few years older. As they started to face this journey, they would be sharing with me what they knew and what they didn't know, the misinformation, she says. She knows she's privileged with incredible access to top-quality health care. Let's just say she isn't struggling to get her estrogen patches. Even so, she says her physician was late to prescribe her hormonal therapy. We are way behind what we ought to know about this phase of life for women. We're way behind on knowing exactly how the hormones change and at what time. We're way behind on sharing information with women, she says. As she started paying it forward to other women, including younger women in her book club, she felt a responsibility to do more. I was like, these are things you need to know, and I started to realize that we are trying to inform one another as women, said French Gates. There's just so much more we can do here to make sure everybody's trained properly, but also that we get the right information out. The investment begins with $10 million to the Menopause Society to train providers, from gynecologists to family physicians. The funds will also continue to support access to contraception and train doctors in menopause care, as well as advance research and care for conditions that uniquely or disproportionately affect women. Most doctors, even gynecologists, don't receive adequate training on menopause during medical school. This is according to one study. Less than one-third of the almost 100 obstetrics and gynecology residency program directors recently surveyed say they receive training in their residencies. We still have so many more women to reach, and this is going to go a long way to help, said Stephanie Fabian, medical director of the Menopause Society and director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health. Fabian says the grant will help make care accessible and affordable. There are areas without trained menopause providers, and only about two-thirds of menopause-certified providers report that they take insurance. For too long, this stage of life, this perimenopause and menopause phase, was honestly invisible, says French Gates. It was like a woman was just expected to deal with it behind the scenes. Effort to change the norms. Whether they are grappling with maternal depression or trying to get treatment for menopause, women shouldn't have to find solutions on their own, said French Gates. Women's health for too long has been underprioritized and underfunded, she says. For every dollar spent globally on health research and innovation, 5 cents goes toward women's health. We need to change that, because we know that what we do, when we do make the right investments in women's health, then women can thrive, she says. Man is the default in medicine, right? That's where the research has been done. The result is that the burden shifts to women, a pattern she has seen throughout her career. She was reminded of it yet again earlier this year, when her ex-husband's name appeared in files released earlier this year of late convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, and the media outlets asked her about it. Whatever questions remain there of what I don't, can't even begin to know all of it. Those questions are for the people and for even my ex-husband. They need to answer for those things, not me, she told NPR's Wildcard podcast in February. Women and victims, many of whom were girls when they first reported being abused, should not alone carry the load of uncovering the crimes these men committed and holding men accountable, she says. Sometimes on these societal issues, we're using the women by default to either answer or solve a problem. I think we need to rethink that as a society and say, you know who's responsible for which pieces? She tells USA Today, how do we change these norms? Mom is living her best life now. French Gates sees writing the balance, particularly in healthcare, as a core part of supporting women leaders. With 1 in 10 women leaving the workforce because of menopause, and an additional 1 in 5 considering retiring early, it can lead to fewer women leaders at a time when they make up fewer than 1/3 of top jobs. They are at the prime of their career, just when the women's about to step into the CFO role or step into the CEO or president role, like she has all this training and knowledge and experience, she says. I think we want that put into the workforce and not taken out. You have to be healthy to be able to do well at your job or at home. French Gates sees hope for women in their 50s and 60s. They're just incredibly enriching years, and I feel lucky to be alive and thriving at this age, she says. They have been some of the most satisfying and productive years of my life. You know, I feel like my youngest says, gosh, Mom is living her best life now. Continuing our reading in the front section of USA Today, we have this headline, Boat Strikes Raise Legal, Ethical Concerns. Some service members are seeking guidance. This is written by Sybil Mays Osterman. The U.S. military has killed more than 200 people in strikes on boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific in the past 9 months, in what legal experts and former military lawyers broadly agree constitute illegal military orders that service members should refuse to follow. While there is no record of troops refusing to follow these orders, at least a handful of service members grappling with these questions have sought legal advice. This is according to anonymous hotlines for U.S. military members. Before the Trump-era boat strikes, the United States viewed the drug trade as a law enforcement issue and tasked the Coast Guard with interdicting boats at trying to bring drugs into the country. Since then, the Trump administration has released no evidence that any of the suspected narco-trafficking boats carry drugs or that their occupants worked for drug cartels. It has never identified the people it killed. Just a handful of names have been published in news reports. Family members of victims filed a federal lawsuit naming their relatives, whom they allege were murdered by the United States. The military has published dozens of videos of the attacks on social media. Grainy black and white videos taken from above of boats speeding through the water before they explode into balls of flame. And Trump officials continue to say the attacks are lawful. At a June 2nd Senate budget hearing, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said every boat strike has a legal officer on the deck that has to make a determination about whether the call is legal or not. The Pentagon referred USA Today's questions to U.S. Southern Command, which oversees military operations in South America and the Caribbean. The command said in a statement, "All operations are conducted deliberately and lawfully, in full compliance with U.S. and international law, including the law of armed conflict. All targeting criteria are developed according to legal, operational, and intelligence requirements," it said. Since the first strike on September 2nd, scores of legal experts and former military lawyers have characterized the strikes as extrajudicial killings or murders. Members of the military are required by U.S. law to refuse illegal orders. Dan Maurer, a retired Army lieutenant colonel and former military lawyer, said he hoped the boat strikes would serve as an example for future generations. "It's going to be a shameful episode in the history of American military operations, and I hope it becomes a case study in what not to do," he said. Legal hotlines receive calls from boat strike operators. Two organizations that provide anonymous legal advice for military members grappling with orders they fear are illegal said they had received calls from service members concerned about the legality of the boat strikes, some from people directly involved in them. Steve Wolford, a resource counselor with Quaker House and the GI Rights Hotline, said he spoke with about four service members involved in the operation who were seeking legal and ethical guidance. One discussed helping plan a strike, and two others were ordered to execute strikes, he said. "I think this is exactly what was described as a war crime," said Wolford. Said one caller to him. Wolford said some of the callers were connected to lawyers, but he wasn't aware of anyone who had refused an order or taken legal action. "Callers are more scared now that they'd be punished if they did bring something up," he said. Brenner Fissel, the vice president of the National Institute of Military Justice, said the Institute's Orders Project, which also advises service members questioning if their orders are legal, receives a steady but small number of calls, including from service members concerned that the boat strikes are illegal, he said. "Some have expressed a sense of being asked to do things that one is deeply conflicted with the morality of doing," he said. "There's a general perception that no one is ever going to be prosecuted for this because President Donald Trump will be able to issue pardons preemptively," he added. "If a service member refuses to follow an order, the case may be brought before a military judge to determine whether the order was lawful. However, before that call is made, service members could be removed from duty immediately." Eugene Fidel, who teaches military law at Yale Law School, said the Pentagon could scrap any charges about illegal orders to strike boats if they arose through the military justice system. Trump could also preemptively pardon service members for acts committed during his term. "The next administration might find its hands tied in terms of prosecuting anybody for obeying such an order, because President Trump may pardon everybody in sight," said Fidel. Service members who object to war based on their beliefs can seek conscientious objector status with the military and be released from deployment. More than 100 people have contacted the Center of Conscience and War, a nonprofit that helps service members apply to file as conscientious objectors. This has happened since late February, according to Mike Prisner, the center's director. Asked whether any service members involved in the boat strikes had refused to follow an order or had been reprimanded for doing so, U.S. Southern Command said it does not comment or on unconfirmed reports, speculation, or administrative matters. Commander who led boat strikes retired early. Speculation swirled around the early retirement of Admiral Alvin Holsey, who led the U.S. Southern Command through the first few months of the boat strikes. Holsey left the high-level job after barely a year in December. Holsey had not spoken publicly or given interviews since he left, but some news outlets reported that he had raised concerns about the strikes. The boat strikes and videos of them posted to the U.S. Southern Command social media have continued apace under General Francis Donovan, Holsey's successor. Six Democratic lawmakers released a video on social media last year urging service members to disobey illegal orders. The FBI opened an investigation, and the Pentagon moved to punish one of the lawmakers, retired Navy Captain Senator Mark Kelly. A federal appeals court blocked the charges against Kelly. Last year, anti-war veterans groups put up billboards along the highways leading to the U.S. Southern Command's headquarters in Doral, Florida, just outside Miami, showing pictures of the boats that were hit, touted on social media by the military. "Don't let them make you break the law," read one. Second strike on survivors heightens ethical concerns. The simmering concerns surrounding the boat strikes boiled over last year following news reports that the first ever boat strike in September left two survivors that the military killed in a second double-tap strike about 40 minutes later. The Pentagon has refused to publicly release footage of that second strike. Lawmakers who viewed it in a classified setting called it deeply disturbing. What I saw in that room was one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service, said Representative Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. You have two individuals in clear distress, without any means of locomotion, with a destroyed vessel, who were killed by the United States. International law prohibits killing adversaries who are wounded or who have already surrendered. However, many experts say the strikes can't be considered war crimes because the Trump administration's case that it's at war with cartels does not stand up to scrutiny. Maurer, the retired lieutenant colonel, said he found it highly improbable that a future administration would prosecute service members involved, both because of the broad popularity of the military and a lack of appetite in Washington to pursue what would resemble a retribution campaign. I don't think criminal accountability is going to happen, he said. The mother and sister of Chad Joseph and Rishi Samuru, two Trinidadian men whose families say were killed in an October 14 boat strike, have sued the U.S. government for damages over the wanton, willful, and outrageous killings. This is according to a complaint filed in January. And relatives of Alejandro Carranza Medina, a Colombian man who was killed in a September strike, filed a formal complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in December, seeking compensation. Stephen Lepper, a retired Air Force Major General, who organized a working group of former military lawyers after Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth fired top lawyers across the military services, says he believes service members who participate in or observe illegal orders will eventually normalize them within the military. We are desensitizing the military to the notion that the orders they're being given may be unlawful. Our next headline, May jobs reports hastens likely rate hike. White House credits policies for strong data. This is written by Andrea Requier and Rachel Barber for USA Today. U.S. employers added 172,000 jobs in May, and data from previous months was revised upward, said the Labor Department on June 5th. Additional confirmation of an economy, analysts say, is on surprisingly firm footing. Job gains were concentrated in leisure and hospitality, local government and healthcare, and the unemployment rate was steady at 4.3%. Average hourly earnings were up 0.3%, an acceleration from April. The report trounced analysts' expectations of an 85,000 jobs gain. Reaction to the blockbuster jobs report. Let's get ready to rumble is what the shocking job numbers are telling us about the economy, said Christopher Rupke, chief economist of FWD Bonds LLC, in a note out just after the release. It's classic supply and demand. There is continuing demand for business services, so companies hire more workers to supply what consumers and other businesses demand. The White House took a victory lap after the report was released. There is clear momentum in the American economy as a result of President Trump's proven economic agenda of tax cuts, deregulation, and energy abundance that's unleashing the private sector, said White House Senior Deputy Press Secretary Kush Desai, who wrote this on X. The Trump administration is committed to building on the success with more job, wage, and economic growth for the American people in the months ahead. White House National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said Friday, the jobs report shows an economy with about the strongest market of my lifetime. Speaking on CNBC, Hassett suggested that despite strength in hiring, the Federal Reserve can watch inflation and wait before taking any action. It's a supply-side driven job market boom, which I think means the Fed can watch the inflation numbers and wait a while before it does anything about it, he said. Well, that's at odds with what private sector analysts who spoke to USA Today, not to mention some bond investors, think. The report bumps up what is now widely expected to be a hike rather than a cut by the Federal Reserve at some point this year, said Liz Ann Saunders, chief investment strategist at the Schwab Center for Financial Research. I think a day like today shows that any of these individual numbers can move those expectations, says Saunders. And even though many recent economic reports have painted a rosy picture, there are some signs of constraints on consumers who remain the backbone of the U.S. economy. Saunders is paying attention to the dwindling savings rate, the uptick in consumer delinquencies, and a slow rising long-term unemployment rate. Why is the jobs report so important? Investors, economists, financial analysts, and all kinds of policymakers consider the Labor Department's first Friday's jobs report one of the keys for understanding the U.S. economy. It helps shape the outlook for wages, consumer confidence, and the Federal Reserve's next step, said ConnectOne Bank founder and CEO Frank Sorrentino in an email to USA Today before the report's release. Professionals have had a long time gauging the economy in recent months. Measures of consumer sentiment are at all-time lows, even though employment has been stable, if not blockbuster. Inflation has been running hot for much longer than forecasters expected and has worsened this year amid the war in Iran, yet Americans continue to spend. For households, the key questions are what this means for job security, income growth, borrowing costs, and monthly budgets, added Sorrentino. Despite all the implications for fiscal and monetary policy, he said, consumers should stay focused on their own financial picture and remain thoughtful about spending, debt, and savings. How strong has the job market been? Data released before Friday's report suggested the job market has been finding its footing. Among other things, the Labor Department's Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, also known as JOLTS, released June 2nd, showed openings rose to the highest level in nearly 2 years. In April, most growth was seen in professional and business services, which had a gain of 668,000 jobs, a record going back to the origins of the report in 2000, said Ken Kim, a senior economist at KPMG, in an analysis. Other measurements of job market health also have been surprisingly strong. Gusto, which processes payroll for more than 500,000 small businesses, said June 2nd, those firms added 83,900 net new jobs last month, the fourth consecutive month of gains. And payroll processor ADP said 122,000 private sector jobs were added in May in its June 3 report. ADP's track record in predicting the Labor Department's report has been imperfect in the past, however. After revisions to earlier months, employment in March and April combined was 93,000 higher than what had been reported, said the Labor Department. The Labor Department has shown signs of cooling in some areas, but from what we see on Main Street, many businesses are still operating, hiring selectively, investing cautiously, and adapting to higher costs. That points to an economy that is moderating rather than falling off a cliff, said Sorrentino. What does the jobs report mean for the Fed? Because inflation has remained high and the economy continues to grow, traders have increasingly started to expect an interest rate increase rather than a cut this year. As of Friday morning, the CME FedWatch tool forecast a 43% likelihood that rates will be higher by the end of the year, and only a 1% chance that they will be lower, a stance weighted more heavily toward rate hikes than before the report. We believe the Federal Reserve will need to raise rates in the autumn, wrote KPMG's Kim on June 2nd. Schwab's Saunders noted that as inflationary pressures are starting to be widespread, it's important to remember the central bank rarely implements a rate change in isolation. Many economists expect that the central bank will take initial steps toward preparing the market for such a move when it meets next in the two-day meeting beginning June 16. The Fed signal will come from the order in which it lists the risks to the economy in its meeting statement. In recent months, policymakers have noted the need to consider readings on labor market conditions, inflation pressures, and inflation expectations. If inflation is listed first at the June meeting, it may signal a shift in strategy. Well, let's turn next to the money section of USA Today. Our lead story, juggling acts. Americans are using side hustles to cover bills. Which pay the most? This is written by Rachel Barber. Whether they're delivering food late into the night, selling handmade crafts online, or creating social media content with the hopes of landing a brand deal, nearly one in three Americans are turning to side hustles to make ends meet as essential costs rise. Side hustles and small business creation boomed following the start of the pandemic as inflation surged and remote work gave employees back time that would otherwise been spent commuting. Years later, prices are climbing again, and new research from Omisend finds 28% of Americans have taken on a side hustle. Nearly half of them, 49%, started one in the past year, and about 54% said they took one to earn extra money for bills or essentials. A separate ZipRecruiter survey estimates the share of Americans with a side hustle is even higher, finding that 35% have an alternate income stream. Following a year of historically weak job growth in 2025, ZipRecruiter economist Nicole Bashaud said this. People are relying on side hustles not only to cover essentials, but also to build a financial cushion because they fear layoffs in a job market that is weak outside of a few resilient sectors. The market sitting the way it did for the last year, I think a lot of people were saying, if I were to lose my job right now, it would be really hard to find something else, said Bashaud. Adding something on the side is just really to prepare themselves for the what-if environment. Who has a side hustle? Side hustles are popular across generations and income brackets. Gen Z's entrepreneurial mindset makes them the most likely to have one, but they're not alone. Last year, a Bankrate survey found 34% of Gen Z, 31% of millennials, 23% of Gen X, and 22% of baby boomers have sought one out. And they aren't just for people scraping by. In fact, high earners are most likely to have a side hustle. The ZipRecruiter survey found that about 45% of those earning more than $150,000 do supplemental work, compared with about 31% of workers earning less than $25,000 and about 31% of those earning between $25,000 and $50,000. It's the old adage, the more money you have, the easier it is to make money, said Corey Kentanga, head of economics for the Americas at LinkedIn. For example, you today are an AI engineer and you're working for a company. There's a lot of AI consulting work there available to you. It's just sitting there waiting for the taking. What are the most popular side hustles? E-commerce has emerged as the most popular way to make extra cash, with people selling handmade goods, secondhand items, and various digital products on such sites as eBay, Etsy, and Facebook Marketplace. The Omisend report found that those with side hustles, about 46%, sell or resell products online, 31% do freelance work, and 21% do social media content creation or run a blog. People are going out less, especially if they have less money. They're wearing their clothes less, wearing their shoes less. It's easier to resell this stuff, said Greg Zakowitz, an e-commerce advisor to Omisend, adding the popularity of resale markets lead him to believe Americans are asking, how do I get money for the least amount of effort? E-commerce seems to be the answer. Of respondents to the Omisend survey, about 39% of e-commerce side hustles said they made more than $1,000 each month. That's compared with about 28% of freelancers, 26% of food delivery workers, and 19% of content creators. What are the most profitable side hustles? Well, using income data from Upwork, a best broker's analysis ranked popular side hustles based on their profitability and career potential. It found that life coaches made the most per hour, $150 on average, but noted demand depends heavily on personal brand and reputation. Content creators for brands are next on the list, making an average of $40 per hour, though income is inconsistent early on. While income depends on traffic and conversions, affiliate marketers make an average of $37.50 per hour. E-commerce freelancers, photographers, t-shirt designers, influencer marketer freelancers, copywriters, and tutors all make upward of $30 per hour on average, said the analysis. It found photo editors, proofreaders, Canva designers, blog writers, and digital artists earn upward of $20 per hour on average. Zakawa said those looking to start a side hustle should remember three things. Time is money. Understanding your finances is key, and being realistic doesn't hurt. The thing people don't realize is you've got to look at the next step ahead, he said. The next step might be a cliff, and you got to be willing to pack a parachute. Our next headline, new SNAP work requirements begin to take hold. More Americans to lose benefits, say advocates. This is written by Mary Walrath Holdridge. Some of the nearly 42 million low-income Americans who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, have run out of time to prepare for new work requirements. The nation's largest nutrition assistance program has undergone fresh scrutiny after it became a flashpoint during the 43-day 2025 government shutdown, which ultimately ended with restored funding, though not before a series of lawsuits. SNAP already has been slashed well before the standoff. However, when President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill passed in July 2025, it outlined tightened restrictions and billions in funding cuts. New work requirements were added to prevent fraud and waste, according to Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins, though the U.S. Congressional Research Service described SNAP fraud as rare in an April 7, 2025 report, stating that available data and reports indicate that many overpayments may be attributed to unintentional errors. Critics have warned against the changes, saying they weaken an important social safety net. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that roughly 3.5 million people lost benefits between July 2025 and February 2026, prompting local politicians, including New York City Mayor Zohan Mamdani, to pass legislation to try to fill the gap. States were given a grace period to enact these rules before recipients will begin to see potential reductions in benefits. In multiple states with large populations, including New York and California, June 1 was the cutoff for work requirements, meaning more Americans are now subject to the stipulations. Here's what to know about new SNAP work requirements. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill passed in July cut an estimated $186 billion from SNAP funding through 2034. This is according to the Congressional Budget Office. It also added new restrictions to the program, including expanded work requirements. Under the bill, non-disabled adults, referred to in government documents as able-bodied adults without dependents or ABAWD, who want to receive SNAP benefits for more than 3 months in a 3-year period must fulfill work requirements if they do not have a documented exemption, medical or situational, physical or mental health, pregnancy, age, assistance from other programs belonging to specified Indian groups. If they are ages 18 to 65, up from the previous top age of 55, do not have a dependent child under the age of 14, down from the previous dependent age of 18, or a veteran, a person aged 24 or under who recently aged out of foster care, or an unhoused person. Previously, these groups were exempt from work requirements. To fulfill work requirements, non-exempt participants must work a paying job at least 20 hours a week, 80 hours a month, or earn a minimum of $217.50 per week before taxes, or perform unpaid work for at least 80 hours per month. You can exchange services for non-money payment, such as doing building maintenance for a reduction in rent. Pre-approval and verifiable proof of hours are required. Or you can participate in an approved education or training program for at least 80 hours per month. This can include college courses, certifications, or credential programs, the SNAP Employment and Training Program, local job preparation courses, and similar initiatives. Participating in a drug or alcohol treatment program also counts. Or you can perform community service or volunteer work for a certain number of hours based on state-specific guidelines. These can include volunteer or work experience programs with local nonprofits or public service organizations such as food pantries, parks, or libraries. Hours are calculated as your SNAP benefit divided by the state minimum wage. An example from New York State. If you get $300 in SNAP and the state minimum wage in your area is $16, then you must complete 18 hours of community service or volunteer work each month, because $300 divided by $16 equal 18 hours. Who gets SNAP benefits? SNAP, also known as food stamps, provides what are known as electronic benefits transfer, or EBT cards, to approximately 12% of Americans for limited time to help purchase basic food items. A large number of recipients are elderly, disabled, or children. To qualify, households must be at or below 130% of the poverty line, meaning they earn no more than 30% more than the federal poverty guideline, which in 2026 was $15,960 for a single person, $27,320 for a three-person household, and $38,680 for a five-person household. A one-person household had a maximum monthly allotment of $298 in 2025, while a three-person household could get a maximum of $785, and a five-person household could receive $1,183, according to the USDA. There are special additional rules for households with elderly or disabled members. SNAP benefits are determined by states and funded by the USDA. Recipients must recertify regularly to maintain eligibility. Typically, benefits can only be provided for 3 months within 36 months, unless additional work-related requirements apply. Approved recipients are given a final timeline to access their benefits. Well, that wraps up today's news from USA Today. I'm Laura Kerrigan, a volunteer reader for the Talking Information Center Network. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.